Hi, I'm Dave Hill, and holy crap, can I say that? Holy crap, are you in luck, because today on the show, creator and star of Comedy Central's The President Show, Anthony Adamaniak, Aaron Foley Chan, plus internet sensation Tony Zarrett. It's The Novelizer. Welcome to The Novelizers. As always, I'm joined by the Robin to my Batman, Stephen. Stephen Levinson, that is. Stephen, what's up?
I'm good. How are you, Dave?
Really great, Stephen. Thanks for asking.
Welcome to The Novelizers. This is the show, if you're just tuning in for the very first time, welcome. This is the show where we take classic films, turn them into hilarious audiobooks using award-winning writers, and then we get them narrated by your favorite celebrities. And speaking of all those people, who's on the show today?
I'm glad you asked. Today we have Anthony Adamaniak. He's a comedian, actor, and writer who created and starred in Comedy Central's The President Show. He frequently performs at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. He has appeared on What We Do in the Shadows, 30 Rock, and Broad City. We also have Aaron Foley Chan. She's a New York City-based writer and producer whose work has appeared on Disney+, Fox, Comedy Central, VH1, and the Internet. Tony Zarrett is a comedian and internet personality known for his deadpan, absurdist satire videos that parody social media trends and online culture, whatever that is.
I don't know what that... It's the whole internet, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, basically.
Anyway, we're chock in the middle, as the expression goes, of Dark Knight. But where exactly are we in the story? What's going on?
I'm glad you asked, Stephen Levinson. The cops have no information on the Joker. Gordon is named commissioner. What? Gordon interrogates the Joker because Harvey never made it home. Batman takes over the interrogation, and the Joker explains that he must choose between saving Rachel and Harvey. What?
How's the good guys going to get out of this one?
Yeah. Anthony Adamaniak, novelize me.
The Dark Knight, Chapter 16, Being a Clown When No One Gets the Joke. Novelized by Aaron Foley Chan, narrated by Anthony Adamaniak. People assume that clowns are always happy. That's why everyone loves clowns. Every single person, without any exceptions. In fact, the first rule of clowning clearly states that clowns should always bring happiness and fun to every situation, even if that clown happens to be having a bad day. And brother, today has been a bad day for this clown. How bad could it be? Well, for starters, I'm sitting on a bench in a prison cell watching an officer lay all my personal possessions on a table. Logging them for evidence, they say. It's such a violation. These are my funniest knives. I've got all the classics. Switchblade, razor, Bowie. But I also have some wacky ones, too. Some homemade numbers. One that makes a squeaky sound when it penetrates a sternum. All of them are crowd pleasers, and I can tell that the booking officer doesn't appreciate them at all. He doesn't even laugh when he sees how big and sharp they are. One of them is tipped in a paralytic poison. That's objectively hilarious, but he doesn't even crack a smile. See? The key to humor is to subvert expectations. Everyone expects the flower to spray water. That's what makes the acid so funny. But no one in this station would understand that. The worst fate for a clown is to be in a room with someone who has no sense of humor. Everyone thinks they have a good sense of humor, but I have found that most people do not. Anyway, I'm in my cell trying to keep my cool. Other prisoners around me are fighting and making such a ruckus. but I sit quietly with a smile on my face because I know that the only true criminal justice system is one where the criminals dole out the justice. Anything else is a farce, and farces are funny. Maybe these other fellas wouldn't fight and yell so much if they had a professional to show them some gags and lighten the mood. And then I realize, hey, that's me! I retreat into my mind palace to think of a good trick I could do, something to really crack my cellmates up. My usual go-to bit would be to maim someone in a funny way, like taking a guy who loves to read and ripping his eyes out or something, but my options are sort of limited. Not a lot of bookworms in here. Besides, these guys won't seem like they would get the irony I was going for. That's the second rule of clowning. A good clown must always read the room. I hear Lieutenant Gordon is talking to the mayor about me. He tells the mayor that my clothing is custom with no labels. If they want to know who my tailor is, they'll have to torture me even worse than I tortured my tailor to get him to make this suit. Gordon also mentions that there are no matches for my fingerprints, DNA, or dental records. It sounds like this guy is obsessed with me, and I'm not surprised. I work hard to embody a kind of mystique and body odor that leaves people in a panic. He says I had nothing in my pockets but knives and lint, but again, there is no mention of how absurd it was that I had so many knives. Why do I even try? I take a deep breath and do my grounding exercise, thinking of things I can see, hear, smell, touch, and taste. All of the options for those are pretty bad in a prison cell. I won't lie. I overhear the mayor appointing Jim Gordon police commissioner, and everyone claps, so I clap too. Of course, I'm a clown who stays in character, so I make sure that my clap is a funny clap. I hope it doesn't look like I'm being sarcastic. I'm genuinely happy for him, and a little jealous. I've been trying to get promoted for years, but it takes something really big to cut through the noise in the clowning community. You have to pick a lane and go hard and really make your audience feel something. Joy, surprise, terror, whatever. You need to make an impression, and that's what I'm going to do in Gotham. I hear the cell door open and close with a loud clank. I try not to giggle as another prisoner is shoved into my cell. You see, I have a little secret. My new cellmate says his insides hurt. I know why his insides hurt. It has to do with my biggest and best gag yet. These guys are going to love it, but I have to wait for my moment. That's the hardest part of this business, waiting for the big reveal. The best trick in the world would be nothing without anticipation. That's the third rule of clowning. Timing is everything. That also applies to magic tricks and live grenades. Suddenly, Gordon rushes out of the room. To the bathroom, probably. The other officers don't know what to do with me. I try to get a card game going, but no one wants to join in. Granted, my playing cards have razors embedded in them, so whoever is playing would get their hands sliced up pretty bad. But that's the joke! I've never been appreciated as a disruptor in the comedy space. My humor's too radical. People feel threatened by new ideas, but do you know what other great comic performers got arrested? George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, John Wayne Gacy. As far as I'm concerned, I'm in great company. An extremely nervous officer takes out his keys and stands by my cell. He keeps asking his friends if they're sure. Sure of what? I'd love to know. I respect that he keeps me guessing. He'd make a great clown if he weren't a mindless cog in the corrupt capitalist fascist hell machine that I'm dismantling. Eventually, he opens my cell, much to my relief. Maybe they've finally seen the humor in terrorizing innocent people. I make sure to lock eyes with the guard. A great clown makes a lot of eye contact with the audience. It keeps them engaged, and if you don't blink, it makes them super uncomfortable. As soon as the cell door swings open, a dozen guards rush in and shackle me. I used to do a trick where I would get put in a straitjacket and handcuffs, and then I'd be thrown into a padded cell to await trial. When I pulled off my escape routine and showed back up on the streets, they'd be speechless. I mean, literally, it was hard for them to speak after I'd gagged them. That's why, in the clowning business, we call our fun tricks gags. Back to my current predicament. I don't know where they're taking me, but unlike these bozos, I actually like surprises. Actually, I shouldn't call them bozos. Bozo was a legend. These humorless dweebs don't deserve to be associated with his name. They shuffle me down the hall like they're afraid I'm gonna bite. But every great clown knows that you save something like that for a closing number, not the middle of the show. This is really my favorite part of the biz. I'm prickling with anticipation for my big finale, and my audience has no idea what's coming. I play it so cool so I don't give away the surprise. That's the hardest part of putting on a show. I'm so excited. I'm ready to burst, like my cellmate is going to do soon. They sit me down in a cold, empty interrogation room. Gordon runs into the room in a panic. Maybe because the sticky got rammed up his ass, got twisted around. That's what I would do with it anyway. I really want to get things back on track, so I'm extremely polite to him. I give him a very civil evening, Commissioner. But he doesn't say hello. He just starts asking where Harvey Dent is. I tell him I haven't done anything and hint that maybe his own officers are working with the mob boss, Maroney. That doesn't land the way I'd hoped, so I try a subtle joke. You're so alone, Gordon, I say with my trademark mischievous glimmer in my eye. This was clearly a joke because he isn't alone. I'm sitting like 3 feet away from him, but he keeps on his where's Dent nonsense. Obviously, I know where Dent is, but I can't give away my big finale. Then Gordon uncuffs me and walks out of the room, rude. As he leaves, I can hear a squeak behind me. The sound of a patent leather boot on stained linoleum. Suddenly I feel like my stomach is being pulled through my throat. Not literally, although I make a mental note to try that on someone later. I feel a rush of excitement because my guest of honor has finally arrived. And he doesn't disappoint. Without a word, he does this hilarious bit where he grabs my hair and slams my face into the cold metal table in front of me. What an entrance. I turn to see that it's really him in the flesh. My big, beautiful bat. We speak the same language, violence lacking any context, followed by a hastily constructed contextual framework so that we can feel good about all that violence. We are the same guy in every way. He knows as well as I do that those useless cops are watching us through the two-way mirror, so we put on a show for them. He pretends to be angry at me, and I pretend that I don't absolutely love this dynamic. We're like Martin and Lewis, with a slightly higher body count. Batman is the ultimate straight man. He always sets me up perfectly for my next gag. He asks me where Dent is, and I'm so close to making a fun joke along the lines of, well, the only Dent I see is in the shape of my face on this table. But I can tell that this is one of those times when the truth is funnier than a joke, even one of mine. So I tell him what we're all thinking, that he has changed crime in Gotham forever. It's so much more fun now, so much more of a show. Then he says something that breaks my heart a little. He asks me why I want to kill him. Me? Kill him? First of all, he's the one trying to kill me emotionally by asking that question. Why would I want to kill him? He's my number one guy. I try to be the bigger man, metaphorically. And I say that I would never kill him because he and I are soulmates. I know it. He knows it. Every worthless, crooked cop behind that mirror knows it. As far as clowns go, Batman is one of the greats. He's got a flashy costume, a silly name, and a defined stage persona. We're two sides of a coin, and that coin is one of those trick coins where both sides are tails. My bat calls me garbage, who kills for money. Which, true, but it does hurt my feelings a little. He and I have so much in common. The flair for the dramatic, the goth overtones, the super masculine vibes we give off. I tell him he's acting like them. The normal people. But they hate him as much as they hate me. Probably even more. When they can't use him anymore, they'll drop him like an empty seltzer bottle. The so-called moral compass of this world has been busted for centuries. It's a bad joke. And I should know. I want to grab him by the cowl and force him to see the truth. He can't be so blind as to think that society will accept him if he plays by their rules. Their rules are always changing. People label things as wrong or evil based on social norms that shift based on a whim. He and I, we're different. We don't fit in because we're true to ourselves. They're the freaks. When things get complicated, these people will drop their civility and cannibalize each other. And we'll sit back and watch. And we'll laugh. And we'll laugh. We're not waiting for the chaos to find us. We seek it out. We're ahead of the curve. I'm trying to explain this to him, but before I can really articulate myself, he pulls me out of my chair and holds me up by my collar. We're back to that old song and dance. He's demanding to know where Harvey Dent is. He just can't let go of what's expected of him by this flawed system. I tell him that these arbitrary rules he's made for himself won't save him. I can tell we're really starting to connect when he slams my body into the wall. I can't help but laughing. Nobody else could make me break character. As much as I respect his chaotic and pointless rage, I feel a little bad for him. He's craving structure and reassurance, and the cowards on the other side of that two-way mirror will never give that to him. Not like I can. The more I can rile him up, the more he'll see that he and I are cut from the same cloth. My whole thing about his rules struck a nerve. He tells me that he only has one rule. He's just proving my point for me. I tried to sound extra cool and say, then that's the rule you'll have to break to learn the truth. When he asks me to explain what I mean, I know that he's going to play right into my hands. So far, he's done everything I've wanted him to do, everything I've hoped he would do. My big finale is going to be amazing. And I can see it all coming together as Batty and Gordon and all my other players do everything I want them to do. I tell him that living without rules is the only sensible way to exist in this world, and that he'll need to violate his only rule tonight. And for a little extra flair, I tell him that time is running out. He's eating out of my hands now, figuratively, of course. The time has come to set him loose. My pawns are all laid out, and now I'll send his pieces across the board. I savor the moment as I tell him that he only has a few minutes to make a choice, to save one of them. He's so confused now because he didn't know that I took both of his favorite people, not just Dent. I tell him that I had thought that maybe Dent was the man behind the mask. I could tell that comment really got to him because he flips me over and slams me down on the table. I'm so excited to see him get more physical with me. As he unleashes his anger, he gets closer and closer to his true self. I love it so much, I let out a little laugh. I know that the more violent he is, the closer he gets to breaking his one precious rule. And when that eventually does happen, he'll finally see that we're equals. I can't express to him in words how much I admire his dark, gritty aesthetic, his penchant for shadows, his inner turmoil, but I can tell him through my actions, manipulating someone through elaborate and cruel machinations is my love language. He slides a chair under the doorknob to make sure we aren't disturbed. Well, we're both clearly pretty disturbed. He's just trying to keep people out of the room. I'm loving every second of this. If you want to see what someone's really made of, what they really care about, you just have to give them a choice. Making someone distill their values into a defining action is always a crowd pleaser. You know who loved the choose between your best friend and the woman you love gag? Timmy Gunderson at his 8th birthday party. Oh, that was a great gig. Those kids really got it. Sure, they laughed at the big shoes and they loved the balloon animals. But when I told him his crush Darla was tied to explosives in one warehouse and his best friend's scooter was in another warehouse on the other side of town, he was howling. I can hear someone trying to open the barricaded door. Gordon, maybe. He's been commissioner for 2 hours and he's about to lose complete control of his precious city. My attention turns back to my bat. I tease him a little. I ask him if Dent knows about him and Rachel. He slams my head into the glass. Oh, I'm so happy I nearly pass out. He has to pick one life or another. I don't even have to say that when he chooses to save his best buddy or his lady friend, the other will die. He could just tell that's the deal. He throws some punches, and with every blow he lands, my plan solidifies a little more. I need him angry. I love him angry. He's so much more fun to be around when he's letting out his feelings. I'm doing a favor by helping him release all these pent-up emotions. He's getting a decade's worth of therapy distilled into 3 minutes of very intense connection with a kindred spirit. And do I ask for something in return? Of course not. I do it for the love of the game. I do it to take down the establishment that has twisted people's minds into thinking that running around like rats in a maze is all that there is. I tell him where both of his beloveds are, and we're off to the races. He takes over, and I sigh in contentment. I've got one last trick up my sleeve, and I'm so excited for him to discover it. All my work is going to pay off tonight. I can just see it now. He'll be completely overtaken by his rage, realize that he's been held back from self-actualization. He'll shrug off the shackles of society, and then he and I can really connect. Will we become best friends? Yes. But the real reward will be the whole city and the rest of the world sees that I'm the most brilliant, powerful and effective clown to have ever lived. I'll be the clown that frees everyone to be their messy, brutal, lawless selves. I'll be the greatest clown to have ever lived. That brings me to the final rule of clowning. Be yourself. Put your own unique spin onto the classics. For instance, everyone pulls a super long handkerchief out of their pocket, right? But I make that trick my own by releasing a poison gas at the same time so I can use that super long handkerchief to cover my own mouth and nose while everyone else chokes. It's all about finding your own voice. Every trick under the sun has already been done, but they haven't been done by you. So put your own spin on it. And maybe someday, instead of people calling someone they revere a bozo, they'll call them a you, and that's no joke.
That was amazing. And we'll be back with more novelizers right after this. That was a great ad for a product I can't recommend enough.
I already own two, and I'm going to get a third.
Yeah.
Unless that was an ad for butt cream, and then never mind.
Blood cream?
Butt cream.
Butt cream.
Yeah,
same difference.
Yeah. Blood cream. Ooh.
Anyway, we're back in black, whatever that means. Every week on the show, we interview someone who worked on The Dark Knight. And this week, our own Christine Bullen talked to one of the actors on the film, Tony Zarett. Let's hear that interview.
Hello, and welcome back to the interview portion of The Novelizers. I'm Christine, and today I am joined by Tony Zarett, who worked on the actual film, The Dark Knight. And I'm very excited to connect with you because, from my understanding, so you were playing a character that was cut from the film. What was the character?
It was the Riddler. And as you know, if you're familiar with the kind of Batman mythos and the sort of who are the most important villains, kind of low level villains, you have the Joker, you know, is kind of a one that nobody really cares about. And then you have someone even more important than the Joker who does something even scarier than joking, and that's the Riddler, which is who's totally different than the Joker.
Got it. Joker makes jokes. Riddler has riddles.
Riddles, and they're different. You have to have Joker and a Riddler because they're so different that the plot's not going to make sense. When Batman's like fighting someone who's being silly, it's the scenes where he's fighting the guy who's being silly with jokes are completely different than the ones where he's fighting somebody being silly with riddles. And if you don't have both of them, you don't really see how the Dark Knight, this dark character, goes up against these chaotic forces of sort of, you know, tricks and humor.
I mean, the Joker that we know from this film, he makes some jokes, but it's mostly just like insane violence and chaos.
It's mean.
It's mean spirited.
Right.
So I want to know, like, what kinds of things was your character doing that they then decided to cut? I want to hear about your character.
Well, it was riddles. It was Batman would have a sort of fight with the Joker, and Batman would think he won, and then the Riddler would come in and do a confounding riddle. And Batman going, this is even worse than a crazy guy, you know, bombing stuff. This guy's confounding me with wordplay type stuff that's also funny, but it also makes you think.
Yeah. Do you have an example? Can you remember one of your early riddles in the movie that was cut?
What has a neck but no head?
Like a muscle? Don't muscle like?
Oh, maybe, like one like of those. Like a, you mean like the like a sea?
One of those sea things that you eat or something? Like now they call like necks.
That works. That would work, but it was a bottle, because you know a bottle you have a neck. They call the like top part of a neck. And by the way, in the cut of the film I was in, Batman said the same thing as you. He asked if it was what, like, you know, a little clam.
Oh, he said
shellfish, and then there was a whole thing between the Riddler before I even said the answer in the movie of Batman and Riddler going back and forth about the difference between mussels, clams, oysters, and stuff like that. Just great stuff that really was important to the world building of the Batman universe and just all
cut.
This was supposed to be maybe a 15, 20 hour film, like a proper film length, and they cut it down to, I don't know what, two, three hours. Because of all the riddles being removed.
Well, yeah. It's interesting because now I'm thinking about when I was watching the movie and there were so many times where I was like, God, I just need a little lightness here.
Well, let me hit with another one.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Sorry, I just thought of one.
Great, great.
I am cold and I am made of ice and cream. What am I?
Oh, I would say ice cream.
Yeah, maybe. I didn't think of the answer, to be honest. I thought of the riddle. Sorry.
Well, gosh, it's a good one. The answer's kind of in the question. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, So that would be a good answer for that.
Also, I have a giant tub of ice cream right here. So it was like the first thing I thought of because I just looked down.
Yeah, I guess. And that's why I thought of the riddle. It was more of a question. But it was a good topic for a riddle. Riddles are much better than jokes because a riddle involves both the recipient and the teller. Because with a joke, you just say the joke and then you say the answer. But with the riddle, the person on the receiving end gets to participate. It's so much more entertaining than the Joker. I didn't see the movie and I wasn't sort of allowed to do a lot of scenes with Heath Ledger, who played the Joker, just because of some sort of stalking stuff that had happened a few years earlier. So we weren't allowed to sort of be in the same room together.
Yeah,
but I assume
you.
Yeah. Yeah. In a sense, in my dreams. And so I was, you know, I was trying to get revenge on him
in real life
for doing that in real life. You know, I waited in the bushes outside his house and stuff. And I tried to, you know, if I knew he was going to get a haircut, I would like wait and get pieces of the hair and then mail it to him and say, this is your hair. Normal stuff that I was kind of just trying to establish a relationship because I knew we
sure,
might
if you're
be
responding to your dreams where he's stopping you, like,
yes.
Of course, you're going to have to respond.
I'm going to get his hair and I'm going to send it to him. Anyway, so we weren't allowed to be. So I don't, and I didn't watch the movie because I was so mad about my scenes getting cut. So I don't know exactly what kind of jokes he was doing, but I can't imagine they were as cool. I got one. I thought of one.
Okay,
yeah. What is, what number am I thinking of?
Oh, nine.
Oh, and just to be clear, it doesn't have to be an integer. So it could be, you know, fractional
pi?
Numbers.
Oh,
and it also does not have to be positive. No, it could be
negative. Oh, like a negative number. A negative number.
Either. Or it doesn't have to be integer. It could be a fraction. So.
Okay. Negative 7/8.
It was 9.
You know what? That's amazing because that was my first guess. So I did get it.
And that was an amazing riddle. Well, and that was, by the way, that reminds me of the movie because another character after they cut out the Riddler, they also cut out a character called the Tricker.
Oh.
And this was, again, there was supposed to be the Joker, the Riddler, and the Tricker, and the Pranker.
Oh, Tricker and Pranker.
Yeah. And these are all totally different things. And yet by the end of the movie, they only had the Joker. So.
Well, this footage must exist somewhere. I mean, if they shot it, it's got to exist somewhere. I want to like make a case for releasing the unreleased footage. And like, you could probably have like 3 other movies in all that footage.
Yeah. It was not clear to me. I don't know if the actual cameras were on or if there was not like a lot of the stuff you normally see in a movie set, the microphones, the cameras, it was just, it looked more like the inside of a, you know what Hardee's is? It's a fast food chain. They don't have it everywhere. Yeah, so I went into one armed and made everybody listen to riddles for, like I said, 15, 20 hours before I was extracted by a SWAT team. But as far as I know, that was the set of The Dark Knight, and I don't know what happened to the footage.
I do just want to throw out this alternate theory that it is possible you weren't on the set, and it is possible that you actually held real people hostage at a Hardee's restaurant. Is that something that you think is possible?
Is this a riddle you're asking me?
No.
Do I think it's possible? 9. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's one of these. We'll never know, you know, and that's why some of these riddles are so hard. We'll never know the answer. What gets smaller every time it takes a bath?
Soap.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're right. I guess I'm not.
Is that the answer?
Yeah, that was the answer. Well, I'm really not much of a riddler, I guess, if I can't confound a podcast host.
What? Hey, that's a give and receive we just did. That's
okay,
a give and receive.
Right.
You gave, right. And I, you know, and that's the whole point of riddles, right? We're supposed to connect on it.
Yeah, you're right. Thank you. Because, you know, I've been a little down in the dumps ever since going to jail, breaking out of jail, all that stuff. So.
I am rooting for you. I thank you so much for joining us, Tony, and giving us a whole new perspective on kind of what this film could have been, you know? And
thank you. Hey, riddle me this. Who had fun on the podcast? Me.
Two people.
So, two people. And that's why we love riddles.
Thank you, Christine and Tony. And thank you. When I said you, I mean the listener. And to a lesser extent, Stephen Levinson. And thanks to my guests today, Anthony Adamaniak, Aaron Foley-Chan, and Tony Zarrett. Please join us next time, won't you? Ta-ta. That means I don't know what the hell that means. Who wrote that? The Novelizers is hosted by me, Dave Hill, and produced by Stephen Levinson. Hey, Stephen. With Graham Douglas, Cole Emhoff, Kevin Carter, Christine Bullen, Dennis DiClaudio, and Rob Kuttner. Music by Cole Emhoff. Additional editing by Sunita Haberlein. Graphic design by Crystal Dennis. Theme song by Andrew Lynn. Performed by Knotts. Additional support by Elizabeth Tavares. Distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. The Novelizers is an AI-free podcast. Written, narrated, and edited, and scored entirely by human beings. Can you imagine that? The Novelizers is a work of unauthorized parody. Follow The Novelizers on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And please support us on Patreon. Copyright 2026, Novelizers, LLC.